Welcome to Your Nerdist Podcast, number 681. Well, what are you guys, what is that?
I was flipping through Instagram and he tried to start like the sound.
He tried to start a sound of a Simpsons.
It's the one that doesn't, it's just a montage shit.
That's all right. Yeah. I'm glad you guys are here for the intro. You get to listen to the Community Corkboard.
Yeah.
What's going on, Katie Levine?
Well, we have...
That's a newsroom, not a corkboard. Thank you for doing that. It's time for the Nerdist Community Corkboard.
Body lift. Oh, dog train. Oh.
What's on the cardboard?
We have a new podcast on the Nerds Podcast Network.
Yes.
It is called Clonecast, and it's Orphan Black's official podcast, you guys.
Whoa.
It's hosted by Rob Moden and Mackenzie Donaldson, who is an associate producer on the show. And each week, they welcome a guest from either behind the scenes or one of the actors from the show to take questions from the audience, hear the theories about the shows, and marvel at their creativity. Also, if you send them your artwork, you can be featured on the podcast.
Are you reading this?
I am.
Okay. What?
Yeah. That's how I talk. So
no, there are going to be a lot of other... So what if the podcast spawns a bunch of different similar podcasts with different personalities?
Just like Orphan Black?
Yes!
Oh my gosh.
What else is on the corkboard?
One of our listeners is doing the Walk for MS, and mm-hmm. they made a team called Nerds for a Cure, and you can help join it. If you are in the Waukesha, Wisconsin area on September 13th, you can join Nerds for a Cure. If you go to bit.do/nerdsforacure, you can get more info on that.
Excellent. Thank you, Katie Levine.
And this is for today's episode?
Yeah, tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Also, this is Jonah Ray talking. I have a video that premiered today from Michael Cronin off of his new album, MC3. The song is called Say, and the video is a parody of You Can Call Me Al by Paul Simon, which includes me, Michael, of course, Kurt Braunohler, Nick Thune, Nelson Franklin, Alan McLeod, and it was a lot of fun to make, and I hope you guys like it. Check it out. It's on Funny or Die.
Nice.
Dog trainer.
babysitter.
Please take one. I'll see if I can find that puppy.
Make cash now for $250 an hour.
Yeah.
Seems really good.
All right.
Are you in line for the bathroom?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This episode is Stephen Tobolowsky. And
Bing!
Yes. Hey, you're the Bing guy.
No, I am.
Yes.
Pass the torch to me.
Stephen Tobolowsky, he's promoting Big Time in Hollywood, Florida on Comedy Central Wednesdays at 10:30.
Great show.
So good.
You can watch all the episodes on cc.com. Also, the Tobolowsky Files. Stephen is a guy that I've wanted on for a long time, and he finally came on, and holy shit, did he not disappoint.
He was amazing.
What a fucking fantastic dude. And then he came on at midnight, he was hilarious, but this podcast went in so many wonderful, weird, fantastic directions that I, and philosophical directions. I adore you, Stephen Tobolowsky, and I really, you know, I mean, for a guy that's done so many amazing things, and for a guy that people still yell Ned Ryerson quotes at, it's just to know how much depth and dimension he has as a human being. I adore him. So this was a huge honor for me. And
you know, in Punxsutawney, the town where they filmed Groundhog Day, they filled in the thing that Bill Murray steps in,
yeah.
And like have like an homage, like a plaque on it.
Oh, that's
okay. Like Ned Ryerson, like the Bing step. They call it the Bing step or something like that. But Julia Prescott, very funny comedian, like just took an Instagram of it because she drove through town out of her way to go take a picture.
That's fantastic. Which is episode number 681. Stephen Tobolowsky!
Katie!
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I have to tell you, we do didn't start here. Like, wait, 20 minutes ago, we were just talking about the draft.
I just walked in to basically a reality show of sports people banging each other.
Well, it's terrible, but that's what you do in sports. I mean,
well, you have a very, and, you know, and it's, I was always jealous of sports people growing up because I was not a sportsy person, you know, and, but in my adult life, it's sort of that thing like from Blade Runner where the guy from the Terrell Corporation says to he says to Rucker Hauer, the candle that burns twice as bright burns half as long.
Yes.
It's sort of like these sports guys, they make a shit ton of money in a very short amount of time, but because their bodies just can't sustain for more than, you know, 10 years. Then they have the rest of their, like, I kind of feel bad for them, but we can do comedy, acting, whatever, forever.
Sort of. We could do it sort of forever. My sports career was really grim. I was on the swim team.
Okay.
And they had a rule back in Texas that you had to have someone enter every event. So they used me for the garbage events. Like, because they had people that would actually win races.
Yes.
So they put me in. It didn't matter if it was 400-meter backstroke followed by 50-meter freestyle in the women's division. It didn't matter. You know, they had to have someone.
10-meter doggy paddle?
Oh, it one event, this was really – we were at Ardmore, Oklahoma doing a swim meet, and I began to drown. I had been in so many – and all I could – I was doing the backstroke, and the idea of the backstroke is you stay on top of the water. You don't want to do that backstroke and be a foot under the surface.
No.
Because then you can't breathe and you're not moving back. And all I managed to get up to the top, and I heard someone in the crowd yell, "For God's sake, someone save him!" But that wasn't the real shame. The real shame was when I finished the race and I got to the end, I did not have the muscular strength to get out of the pool.
Okay.
So my arms were like noodles. So I'm there. And they're getting ready. They're warming up to start the next race. And people are swimming and getting the and I'm still in the pool. And they say, "Son, you can get out of the pool now." I said, okay. I couldn't. My arm was like a noodle. You know, I slapped it up. There was no strength. So I had to get out of the pool the way Shamu gets out of the pool at SeaWorld. I had to, like, jump up and beach myself and then roll over to the stands.
Did they give you a sardine as a treat?
I wish. Really,
that would be it.
No, it's terrible.
Now, why were you in the swim team if this wasn't something that – or did you want to be a swimmer, or did someone make you because it was an athletic school thing?
Yeah, I think the first element of it was that I was so bad at all other sports. And the second element was that the men, we weren't men. I was like in eighth grade. The boys and the girls were on the swim team together. And you got to see a lot of girls in swimsuits.
There
and
you go.
Then I heard that one of the girls on the swim team liked me. So
probably
so,
not after that performance.
Well, I think she hung in there. if and this is just like a message for all you people out there, if a woman will love you after you drowned in front of other people, stick with her. Don't dump her.
That's a keeper.
That's a keeper, man. That's a keeper. She was the first girl I ever made out with, and I didn't know we were going on a double date to make out. We were going to hear Peter, Paul, and Mary or something like
sure.
that. And we were in the back seat of someone who was old enough to drive. Someone drove the car there.
How old are you at this point?
Oh, I guess I had to be 15.
15, okay.
And the guy who was driving the car was like 16.
Sure.
Had a learner's permit. And we stopped, and she had – I remember she had just eaten a hot dog with onions and mustard.
The best makeout pre-op.
Well, it satisfied so many urges. You know, it was not only a delightful to have a first – to go like, oh, that's what lips feel like when you kiss them, but also, and that's one good dog.
Did you end up dating that girl for a while?
I did for a while. I did for a while. And then she dumped me for somebody who was older and more talented.
Talented at what?
Someone who played the guitar very well, who sang very well. But back then, my talents had not emerged. I was just someone who drowned on the swim team. Yeah, I wasn't an actor at that point in time.
Did you ever talk to her again? Like, especially after you hit it big, did you ever talk to her?
I saw her again, I want to say about 10 years ago. She came to Los Angeles, and we had Mexican food together, which is a great thing. And I have to say, she is still absolutely gorgeous. Still absolutely gorgeous. And now what I believe she does is she writes, mm-hmm. and she writes poetry, and she also does travel trips, author trips to Europe.
Uh-huh.
So she organizes, like, come see Charles Dickens' home, come see this home, come do this. So she's very much into the literati kind of excursions.
What types of girls were there? Did you have a type when you were in high school?
Breathing. Breathing. That was
breathing and willing.
I was not popular. I was skinny, and I had this thing where I had regular internal bleeding. And
what?
Yeah, I was ill, and I had acne, and my mother felt it was a waste of time to buy clothes for me because I was growing so tall. So I had the same clothes every day. I was not a catch. I was not a catch, but I think it was the illness. It was the illness I had because the doctors told me I couldn't do sports anymore. And that it was too hard on me. They weren't too sure why I was having these internal hemorrhages. It wasn't a good, happy.
What was it?
I don't know. It was. I have a theory. I was doing a play during the summer, right when I was about to turn 13. It was a play called The Ghost of Hoot and Holler.
Okay.
Real biggie. And the director changed the title to The Ghost of Pumpkin Holler because she didn't want the audience to think it was too rowdy of a play.
Sure, and Hooten really brings in a bad element.
A bad element. And we won our little divisional title of first place, and I won best actor. And we had a celebration in her backyard. And she said, make sure you don't eat anything that falls on the grass because I just sprayed it for chinch bugs.
Oh.
And I remember I sat in that grass eating watermelon and potato chips thinking, this acting thing is opening up. Maybe we could take this hoot and holler thing on the road. And that night, I had these – I don't know if this is suitable for all listeners.
Yes, of course it is.
Suitable, it is.
Yeah.
I had these terrible cramps, and I ran to the bathroom, and I was bleeding internally. And I screamed and got mom and dad. Dad was a doctor. And I had internal bleeding every day for the next 2 years.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. And I couldn't eat. So I went to all sorts of specialists. No one has ever heard this story, by the way.
Oh, this is a – I'm thrilled to know. You mean in all the times of the Tobolowsky Files, isn't
it? It'll be in a new one, but this I've never told.
By the way, on the upside, you were chinch bug free. For 2 years, no chinch bugs.
Not a chinch bug on me. No, so the thing was I couldn't eat. I couldn't eat, and the doctors figured whenever the peristaltic action began, it – eliminated lining of my intestine, and I began bleeding again. So he said, you have to stop eating. You have to stop eating this, that, the other. I couldn't eat cake, ice cream, anything. I was anemic. I was weak. He said, you can't do sports. You have to stay indoors. I was becoming a shadow of my former self. But rather than if I had my wits about me, I would have been suicidal. I would have been so depressed. But I was a moron. I had no idea about how bad my condition was in. And I thought, well, I could stay indoors. And I began reading plays. And I began reading Shakespeare for the first time. And I thought, well, this is great. And, you know, I bet you it was that crossroad, the kind of after that. After I got well again when I was 15, I was in plays and not in sports. I was an actor and began doing the Trojan Women and doing The Miser by Molière and all these plays that we did at school, all because I think I had shifted gears.
That's a pretty incredible story. That if you know to lose that 2 years of your life to a malady of that sort, but then say, well, if I hadn't had that, my life would be much different now. It was almost weirdly, I don't want to say worth it, but kind of like it's changed your life.
Oh, well, haven't you met a lot of people like that? I know I have people who've had cancer and things like that who said, surprisingly, the best thing that ever happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And you could sort of see it in a philosophical way. Why? Is because what's bullshit is gone, and what is valuable you cling to, and you become refined and defined, and you move forward in a certain path. And I was too young to know what was happening to me, but, you know, I have this theory that we look at our lives as a form of simple arithmetic. And when we can view our lives as a form of when we can view our lives as a form of addition, we're very happy.
Mm-hmm.
Like me sitting here talking to you, big time addition, very happy. Me with this, hey, I got free water, very happy here in Los Angeles. We have that in Los Angeles, very happy with that. But when your life is subtraction, it's the other way around. And you could even be happy if you see your life as possible addition in the future. If you see like something good coming to you in the future, you feel happy. But if you see your life as subtraction, it's not so cool. And everybody who listens to my podcast, you know, they know the story of me and my broken neck, of all that. When I broke my neck in Iceland, then it was a matter of, okay, I couldn't do anything, and I couldn't work, so you lose money. My whole life was subtraction. In a way, this period of time when I was young, 13 to 15, my life was a lesson in subtraction. All of the things I did, I couldn't do anymore, and I didn't know it, but life will find a way, and yeah. I began to redefine myself.
Well, I think, you know, part of that is, I mean, I think there are things that maybe are obvious addition and obvious subtraction, but then there are other things that I think are our perception of a situation being addition or subtraction. And a lot of people, and, you know, I mean, you know, having been in the business for a long time, and you probably see tons of, you know, you see tons of talented people come and go. And you go, well, I wonder where that person isn't doing more or isn't happier, isn't. And then you kind of get to know them a little bit and you go, oh, because they see everything as, to use your term, a subtraction. And that is a devastating and very destructive way to live your life.
Yeah, you can't do it. And I've developed a philosophy that's no philosophy at all, and that everything that happens to you is a door or is a prison. I've seen both. I've seen people who have gone from nothing to enormous success, and they become imprisoned by the success. And I see people who – I have friends of mine who suddenly became vastly wealthy, and you think like, oh, cool. No, imprisoned by the wealth.
What do you think that is about the success and the wealth?
It – wow. I think it is maybe – it could be that you – let's just take – success. That's a simple one because that's something that you generate with other people. Like I've seen people get successful jobs on sitcoms. These are actors who couldn't get a job, were waiting tables, were finding life difficult. Suddenly they get a big job on a sitcom. They're making 40 grand a week. The show is successful. They're making piles of money. And next time I see them, they are complaining that they have no freedom. So they went from not being able to do anything because they had no money to having money but having no freedom.
Right.
Now someone asked me the other day, as you can imagine, kind of I get emails from a lot of people asking advice about different odd things. And this one kid, he was in college, he said he knew what he didn't like, but he couldn't find the real him, mm-hmm. the real me. How do you define yourself? And the only thing I could think of is that you really don't. There is no real you. There is no real me. We know what we like. We know what we don't like. But as you go through life, you have different prisons, different blessings, and you have to have the wherewithal to understand, my goodness, I'm in this trap.
Sure.
And move on. With money, how many times have you been shopping someplace either for cars or clothes and you don't want to get something because it costs too little? I could get the sport coat that costs $200, but I was shopping in New York and I put on the sport coat at this store that we walked by and I go, this is a nice looking sport coat. And the woman said, should we get the tailor out to look? Maybe. And then my wife answered, wait a minute. Let me look at the price tag. $18,000.
So you got two.
I got two. I got one. And they were both in blue. In case I spilled spaghetti,
yeah,
I won.
Exactly. You want to have a backup.
Could you imagine? Okay, there you go. Here's a perfect example. So you get your $18,000 sport coat, and what a prison is that? Could you imagine eating Italian food with that sport coat? Could you imagine moths? Oh, my God, there's a moth in the house.
Sure.
Could you imagine, like, driving in a car and you don't want to sit on the coat and you put it over? Oh, my God, there's a wrinkle. Or taking it to the dry cleaners. What happens if they ruin it? The amount of stress that would enter your life with that $18,000 coat.
That's why that's why you buy $10 sunglasses.
Right.
I'm probably going to step on these. I'm going to lose them. And it doesn't fucking matter. Like, right. I think, and I'm not saying I'm amazing at this, but I do try to tell people, you know, you're happier when you don't define yourself by the external reference in your life, because that's all fluid and it comes and it goes, and you can have success and you can have not success. You could have a nice car, you could have a shitty car. It doesn't matter. If you are not happy with the process of living, then it doesn't matter what you have. And then I think the successful and the people who get the success and the wealth get more depressed because they go, well, this didn't fix me. What the fuck is left? You know, so you really, I find the people that are happiest just enjoy life. They enjoy the process. John Cryer was on the podcast yesterday and he had a great quote about, you know, I just enjoy how dumb the entertainment industry is. And that's why I'm always happy, because I enjoy how silly the process is. And of the hundreds and hundreds of people I've talked to, the ones that enjoy the process and just like kind of see life as an adventure and sort of bend with whichever way it goes, those tend to be the happiest people.
Right, right. Now, I would agree with everything you say about material possessions, with one exception, and that is my Mercedes.
It's a nice car.
It's a nice car.
I saw it in the parking lot.
This car has really changed my life.
Tell me about it.
Before I had this car, people would stop me at the gate of studios, uh-huh, and they say, excuse me, sir, we don't have your name on our list. Will you please just wait over here? When I went over there in the 4Runner, you know, just get with the dog fur in it. Will you please just get over here, sir? When I drive up in the Mercedes, they think their list is wrong. I drive up in there and they go, your name's not on. I'm sorry, sir. Just go right in. Please don't have me fired.
Take the special entrance.
Please. Yeah. Please. You could park in the handicap spot. Please just go ahead. So.
Yes. I meant everything but that. I'm sorry.
Everything but that. And you get a lot of respect from the valets.
Yes,
too.
Of course.
A lot of respect from valets. So there is something to my Mercedes, but you can have it. It's mine.
No, I can understand that. But also, you know, it is sort of in a creative industry, it's very difficult because it's not as cut and dry in terms of the path that you take. It's very windy and circuitous and you never know. And so sometimes the only thing you have is like, oh, well, I guess I'm doing, I guess the career is going fine. I have this car, you know, and I guess that's a way. Well, there are very few things that we can measure because there's no steady progression for us.
Absolutely. One thing people, when I see either writers or actors, they always ask for a bit of advice. And the one advice I give people is do something. Do something. If you do something, you are already 94% ahead of the game because of all the people who talk about wanting to do something and don't do it.
Absolutely.
They don't do it. They don't write the book. They don't do the podcast. They don't audition. They don't get their pictures. You have to just step forward and do something. Example. Yeah. When I had that horrible broken neck thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I broke my neck. I couldn't really do much. But it was because that doctor told me I had a fatal injury, right? He looked me in the eye and said I had a fatal injury, which is generally not good when you're looking at a living patient to tell him something like that.
That's a bad...
Bad bedside manner.
Yeah.
But I came home and I thought it was amusing. Yeah, like John Cryer. I thought it was amusing that the doctor told me I should be dead. And I thought, what if what he said was true? Why don't I begin, since I couldn't do much, why don't I start writing the stories down of what I would want my kids to know about me in case I had died? And I began the stories, and that became the Tobolowsky Files, and that became the radio show, and that became the book with Simon and Schuster, all because I did something. And when my cousin Tina, and I love you, and I mean this, I mean it. When my cousin Tina slipped and fell in Denver and broke her hip, and she called me up on the phone and she said, Stephen, do you have any advice on what to do when you have a major break? I'm going to be on my back. I said, yes, don't watch television. Do something. Use that period of time. The greatest gift we have in the world is time. And the only way we can honor it is with choice. So you take this broad sheet of paper in front of you and you do something. I said, Tina, either read some book that you always wanted to read and you never thought you would have time to read. Listen to a type of music you would never thought you'd do anything before. Write down your memories of when you were a child. Something. Do something. And after her 3.5 months, she called me up on the phone. They took the cast off and the pins out of her leg and said, Stephen, you're going to be so disappointed. I just watched TV.
Was it even educational TV?
No.
No, just soap operas.
Just watch TV. And, you know, what can you do?
You can't.
And it is 94% of the people will do not. They will do nothing. They won't do it.
And I don't have a problem with that in the sense that if someone just wants to watch TV all the time and that makes them happy, fine. But don't be the kind of person that goes, well, how come my life isn't better? And you kind of look at me and go, well, you know, there are certainly external forces, things that you can't control. You can control how you react to those things. But I think there is a percentage of your life that could be improved if you really took a close look, wrote everything down, and went, oh, I guess I don't need to watch TV 3 hours a night. I could go – I mean, you should watch At Midnight from midnight to 12:30 or Talking Dead on Sundays when we're back. But outside of that, if you really looked at your life, you would realize there are places where you could be doing something to give yourself the life that – instead of just being a complainer.
Exactly. When I – back to the broken neck, I made a vow to myself during this period of time, let me read something that I always said I should read and never have gotten around to, never would read it in a million years. And I picked the Jewish Talmud, like 71 volumes written in Aramaic 2,000 years ago, right? And of course – I've read 8 volumes so far, but I started reading it, and this is a line I came up with after sitting with my broken neck in the yard. It was – there is a story in which someone is injured. Now, this is written 2,000 years ago. Someone is injured and in bed, and someone – a friend comes and extends a hand to try to help this person, extends the hand, and he says before he grabs him, is your affliction dear to you? And the man in the bed says, no. And then the friend says, then take my hand. A lot of us, our afflictions are dear to us. We define ourselves by our afflictions. We define ourselves by our subtraction. When I first came out to L.A., it was amazing how cool we all were. Young actors with no work, no agents, no prospects. And we were cool. We looked at other people as kind of like people who worked on sitcoms as sellouts.
Right.
People who were in bad movies as losers. But we were like Nowheresville until we started getting our first jobs, and then our friends called us sellouts and losers. People wanting to embrace their affliction, making it dear to them. So I'm careful now with the things that people see at what's wrong in their life, because sometimes that's who they want to be seen as.
Sure. Well, because it's – if you define yourself by – first of all, defining yourself by your afflictions is – it can be very comfortable to people. It's and discomfort. People spend a lot of time avoiding discomfort. So you will stay in a bad situation because it is familiar to you. And on top of that, when you are afflicted, other people typically have to come deal with you. It's very empowering to be afflicted, and that's where comfort comes in, and that's where, you know, so it is a seductive path, but you should absolutely not take it.
You know, I never saw the social aspect of that before. That's absolutely true. And once some of us started getting work as actors, you're right. The social thing started to fall away and resentments built up, and you were kind of a loner. You were kind of on your own after that. I have to think about that. I think that is great. It is a powerful social force to be a loser. I love it.
Kind of. Because I mean, you know, and also when you look at a lot of our pop culture, you know, most of our protagonists now are fucked up and flawed and despicable, you know? I mean, it's sort of funny, and then we identify with that. We're like, oh, yeah, you know?
Liam Neeson. You know, it in enough now that he, you know, after Taken and Taken 2, I've seen Taken, I think, about 30 or 40 times.
Oh, you have?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, it is the most satisfying film I've seen in decades. It's and they were so clever in finding a villainous group that they could beat up without offending anyone. So what is it, like Albanians or something?
Yeah.
It's like Albanians. It's like it's time to knock those Albanians down a peg. Damn it. You know, it could be anybody. You know, but it was great. But later, the latest one, Liam Neeson's film, he's still the same hard-ass, the kick-ass guy, but he's a drunk. You're right. The air marshal on Nonstop. He's the air marshal, and he's flawed and everything on Nonstop, and he screwed up, but he still kicks ass on that plane. We need a hero that kicks ass even though they're flawed.
You know what? I want to see Stephen Tobolowsky in Taken 4. I want you to be the guy because, I mean, look, Liam Neeson is a very on-the-nose badass guy. But I think you calling someone and going, hey, you know, I mean, if you, in a very genial manner, you want to kidnap my family, that's fine. I think, actually, would you please say I have a special set of skills?
I have a special set of skills.
See?
And you know, when people like me go off, you know, we don't do it in a cool way like Liam Neeson. We do it in a very uncool way, which could be very scary. I remember I was talking to my girlfriend Beth years ago on her way home from play rehearsal, telling her, if somebody approaches you, you know, wants to rob you or something, just run. Don't confront. Just drop your purse. Run. You have nothing to do with these people. You know, better be safe than sorry. We get to our house. I hear the back door slam. Next thing I know, I am standing in the backyard with a butter knife in my hand saying, come on out, motherfucker. I'm here. Come and get some of this. Come and get some of this. And I'm going, and then I look and I'm holding this damn butter knife. And Beth comes out and says, Stephen, come inside. Come inside. There may be someone out there. Come inside. When people like us, when bald people with glasses go off, it is scary.
Who was at your house? Did you ever find them?
No.
Did they take anything?
No, but I suspect that particular time it was either a friend of ours who had a key to our house and was house sitting, and he was already out of earshot by the time I got out the back door. Or he would have come up and had a beer with me.
I mean, you're...
Or maybe it was somebody bad.
You're very lucky. You're very lucky. But I do understand that I think there is some sort of an instinctual, I must protect my turf. But at the same time, that, you know, I mean, unless you were good enough with a butter knife that you could throw it and lodge it in the barrel of a gun, maybe,
or unless we could just sit down and have some cheese and crackers.
Come on in.
Come on in. You know, let's talk this over.
We'll do a formal robbing. And
yeah,
then
we'll
I don't really need that anymore. You're doing us a favor by getting it out of here.
It's terrible. Yeah. So, you know, when the instinct comes to be a badass, it's not a cognitive decision. It's a DNA thing that we have no control over. So, yeah, I think I could do Taken 4.
By the way, if people want to hear, because obviously you've worked on hundreds of things, and if people want to hear those stories, I mean, I'm hesitant to start picking at you for different things that you've worked on. Because that's all in the Tobolowsky Files, which is still produced by distributed by PRI.
Right now we're just on iTunes and all that stuff.
Yeah, okay.
So we have a new one coming out. I think the one coming out is this week. Is the one kind of I started with you about my malady.
Okay,
that'll be coming out this week, called Maps of the Ancient World. But I think we have 70 now.
Isn't that crazy?
70 hours. And they're played by different radio stations across the country, too, sometimes. I just hear from people like in Louisville that they have parties where they listen to Tobolowsky Files, and Dallas and Austin. It's just different places. But, yeah, they're usually entertaining, I think.
What's your favorite project that maybe people aren't as familiar with? You know, because obviously everyone kind of has their favorites of things that you've been in, but like, what's your favorite?
Like the favorite, like kind of sleeper things that I've been involved in. There was one great movie I was in that no one has seen called Pope Dreams. Julie Haggerty's in it with me.
It's amazing.
It's a wonderful script. It's a wonderful movie. And we went to a few film festivals. It's just wonderful, wonderful film. And, of course, I love, 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 which is also kind of a sleeper, Stephen Tobolowsky's Birthday Party.
Right.
It even has my name in it, where is the first storytelling movie I told, where we've been all over the world with that in film festivals. That's a great, great movie. It's a lot of fun. Here comes the throat again.
I didn't, yeah. And you also, you co-wrote True Stories, right?
Right, with David Byrne with David and Beth Byrne. Henley. Yeah, we that was hysterical. What is it about producers? David hired me, and then he hired Beth, and they said that they wanted a first draft in 19 days. 19 days. So we're up for 24 hours, you know, writing. We hand them a first draft, and then we hear nothing for like a year.
Oh, yeah, hurry up and wait.
And nothing for a year. And then I see David riding his bicycle up in the Hollywood Hills. He goes, oh, Stephen, I kind of been rewriting True Stories, and we kind of took out everything you did, but we're getting ready to shoot that soon anyway. But I want to come over to your house anyway and play you some of the songs. And he came over, and I'll never forget him playing Wild, Wild Life.
Yes.
In my living room with his guitar, just doing, I'm going like, well, David, that's such a good song. Man, that's good. And then he did a recording. I told David some of the ESP stories I had from my past, these strange ESP moments I had where I used to read people's tones.
What?
Yeah. It's a scary, awful, horrible thing, but I was in college, and we were at a movement retreat, and we were going around the circle, and our teacher was saying, say the first thing comes into your head, and the first guy goes Hobbit, the next guy goes Far Out, next guy goes Weed, next guy goes Hobbit, next guy goes Hobbit.
I'm glad to know things haven't changed at all. Those are still the same things you would hear now.
And he comes to me, and I said, I get that you're not who you say you are. I get your name is really MK or ML. And then that goes around the circle, Hobbit, far out, Frodo, beer, and it goes back around. So we disperse. Then we're headed out for our cars, and my teacher kind of corners me. He said, why did you say what you said? I said, well, I don't know. You said, just say the first thing came into your head. That's the first thing came in. He says, because it was right. I do have an assumed name, and my initials are MK.
Oh.
And I went, oh. He says, would you care to do an experiment with me? And I said, well, sure. He says, can you come over to my house? I have this thing I want you to try. So I went over with Beth over lunch the next day, and he brought out this thing called a Japanese prayer stool. He says, it's a powerful instrument of psychic transfer. Who knows? You know, it was some little stool. But we sat across one another in the stool. He says, take my hands. And I was averse to holding my teacher's hands at the time. But anyway, I grabbed his hands, and he says, so what do you – I said, well, yeah, there's a 5-year-old over here by the fireplace and a 40-year-old woman on the phone. And he got pale and stood up and started walking around the room. And I said, are you all right? And he said, well, I was supposed to babysit my sister's 5-year-old child. He was playing by the fireplace. I told him to get away from the fireplace, and he ran out of the house and was hit by a car.
Oh, my God.
And my sister, at the age of 40, committed suicide on that phone. She called me up and killed herself while she was talking to me on her 40th birthday. So all of a sudden, I'm going like, mofo. Well, we didn't have that expression back then.
No, but that I was, think whatever the time-appropriate equivalent was.
So my girlfriend, Beth, at the time thought, we have a real money-making thing here.
No.
You know, we'll have people pay a quarter or a dollar or whatever and have you read their tone.
So she instantly saw dollar signs while your teacher
Bing.
Is melting down.
Bing. So she would round up people, bring them into the green room or whatever. And you would think it would be funny, but I would go like, you just got an inheritance and you want to know how you're going to spend that money. And they would get up and cry, and everybody would have these creepy, creepy, creepy feelings. And Beth loved me for it. And she thought like, this is so cool. What are my tones? And I quit. I said, I got to quit doing this because this is way creepy and I don't really like it. So while that 19 Furious Days that we were working on, True Stories, Beth says, tell David, because David wants to put all these true stories in his movie, Stephen, tell him the true story about you hearing tones. And I said, no, baby, no, I don't want, no, tell him the story about you hearing tones. So I sat and told David the story of me hearing tones. And he looks, says, you're kidding? And I said, no, David, that's really the story, but I don't do it anymore. I don't like to do it anymore. It was too creepy, and I don't like to do it anymore. So anyway, sure enough, a year later, David has written into True Stories a character that hears tones, and he wrote the song. That day he came over and played Wild Wild Life. He says, here is a song I wrote for you, Stephen. And we put it in the thing, and it was Radiohead. I'm picking up something good, Radiohead.
I know the song because yeah. Radiohead named themselves after that song.
So Radiohead got their name from the song David Byrne wrote based on my psychic experiences when I was in college.
Does Tom York know this story?
I don't know.
He owes you a lot. That is an incredible. That's incredible.
It's incredible, and it was weird. But you know, I've had these psychic things through my life, and it doesn't make me believe that in magic. But it has made me believe, you know, everything is a door, everything is a prison. It makes me think that we are bigger than the sum of our parts, that the thing, you can't define yourself because you are not you, and it keeps changing, and it's bigger than what you imagine you are, and which is why you shouldn't watch television. Don't watch television. You're bigger than that.
But I do, you know, if I were to extrapolate any meaning from this kind of a thing, I am more than capable of justifying something like that by saying, hey, you know, we are just a collection of vibrating molecules. And, you know, if there are frequencies, if we emanate some type of frequency and someone else is sensitive to that, it doesn't, I mean, hocus pocus, I always think, is just science that they haven't nailed down yet. So
exactly,
there's something sciencey behind it.
And believe me, if you have any kind of psychic stuff, it doesn't pay off. My believe me, there's no big payday at the end of this. My wife, Ann, she wanted to do a real special birthday thing for me. So she didn't want to tell me anything about it. And I got this real clear hit in my head. And she said, you know, just dress up like, you know, you're going to meet the president or something. You know, just wear something nice. And I went like, oh, motherfucker. So I said, Ann, I think I know what this is. And I tell you, I'm going to write down on a piece of paper, put it in a sealed envelope, and put it on your desk. So we'll all know that I'm right or wrong. So we get in the car, and she says, I'll give you directions. So we start driving, and we start driving downtown. And I went, oh, no, please let me be wrong. And we get to downtown, and we drive to Disney Hall.
Uh-huh.
And I go, we park underneath. And she said, just park underneath here. We're going to meet some friends for lunch here. No, please don't. We get on the elevator and we go up to the concert hall, and there is a grand piano. And she says, your birthday present is you get to play on the grand piano in Disney Hall for the next hour. And she had a friend come and bring my music, and I went out on the stage and I started playing. And she went home and opened the fucking envelope, and it said, taking me to Disney Hall to play on the piano.
Oh, that's crazy.
And she was furious. So the traditional birthday party sex
didn't happen.
Didn't happen that night.
You could have written underneath, P.S., you're not going to have sex with me after reading this.
So she said, so were you like, what? Snooping on my computer? What were you doing? Were you reading my emails? What were you doing? Were you looking behind my back? I said, no, baby, I'm so sorry. It was just one of those things that I just saw it in my head and I wrote it down and it just turned out to be true. And there was no happiness, no joy in Mudville that day.
No, Mighty Steven had struck out. Yeah. But you did get to play in Disney Hall.
I did get to play.
And how was that?
It was amazing. When you play the piano in Disney Hall, for you people out there who play the piano, you'll know what I'm talking about. You hear the report of the treble keys off that back wall. Even when you're playing pianissimo, could I use those foreign words?
Yeah, we're not afraid.
Even when you're playing like as quietly as you could possibly play, you hear that report come off that back wall the same way a comedian does. Like last night I did a sitcom.
Yeah.
The same way you do when you're on stage with the audience there and you have laugh lines that you're trying to get and you feel the laughter. It's the same way at Disney Hall when you're playing the piano. You feel the report coming back to you. It was one of the greatest birthday presents I ever got.
Well, at least you got to enjoy that part, even though you kind of knew what it was.
I knew I was headed for trouble.
I do like the idea that type of psychic thing is like, you don't want this, trust
no.
me. Because then there's the other thing. There's the other sort of Matrix thing of, you know, would you have knocked over that thing if I hadn't told you? Like, is there any part of you that ever worries, well, what if this is just a self-fulfilling prophecy and like maybe it's true or maybe it's not true and there's a series of infinite possibilities of how this could play out, but subconsciously I choose, you know, like the sort of difficult in the sense of you guessing what your wife is going to get you for your birthday, but I wouldn't want that power because I would get too much in my head about whether or not it was...
And whether... what if you depended on it,
right?
Then you would be wrong. And if you were wrong, then it becomes the prison. There was a story of a girl in Finland, a woman. No, she was a woman in Finland who started speaking this ancient Finnish dialect. And everybody thought she had past lives. And she thought she had past lives. And what the investigation uncovered was, as a child, her mother would pick her up from school and she would sit in the library and read these old Finnish folktales. And her mind memorized this language, this ancient Finnish language. And she didn't even remember it, but her brain remembered it. It's like I was riding to the bank on my bicycle. I had $17,000 in three checks that I was taking to the bank. This was a lot of money for us. It still is a lot of money for us. And I felt so virtuous riding to the bank, and I get in line and I pull out the deposit slip and the checks are gone. And they had all been endorsed, all gone. I ride my little bicycle home, and Ann said, "Well, if you have that psychic ability, you better come up with where the checks are." And I said, "Just be quiet a second, just be quiet." And I stopped and I saw the checks. I said, "I see the three checks. They're up against a hurricane fence. They're up against a hurricane fence. And so I will ride my bicycle the same route and try to find where there would be a hurricane fence." So I'm riding down, Riverside. And I think, wait a minute, L.A. River. L.A. River has hurricane fence around the So I parked my bike and ran down to the river and went along. And there were the three checks stuck up against the fence by the wind, endorsed, picked them up, put them in my pocket, went back to the bank, deposited them. But I saw it in my head. Now, doesn't happen all the time, or I wouldn't be an actor, would I? I'd have a better job with more security. I wouldn't be auditioning for these parts because I knew I wasn't going to get them anyway.
I hope you at least got birthday sex after finding the checks again. I mean, that was an incredible...
Let me tell you, out there, if you're listening out there, finding check sex is much better than birthday sex.
That is a double victory. That is a double victory. But also, I love that you were still riding your bike in Los Angeles, which to me is a very dangerous place to be a cyclist.
Don't do it anymore. Learn that lesson.
Did you get hit?
No, I didn't get hit, but I only did it that time because I felt virtuous because I had earned $17,000.
Yes.
So I felt like, okay, I've done my financial health. Now let's work on my physical health. Yeah, that not going to do that anymore. It's too dangerous. I don't see how people do it.
Yeah, it's. I've had many friends get run off the road, hit by cars. People in Los Angeles just don't. You know, every city says, like, oh, our drivers are the worst. L.A. drivers are very bad. You know, even New York, as frenetic as it is, people seem to have understand how to create order from the chaos. There don't seem to be any lanes on the streets in New York. If your car can fit, it's a fucking lane. But they all know that. Here, there's just a general, like, we're not on a grid. The streets aren't well planned. They're not maintained. It's a fucking disaster here.
People don't drive that fast in New York. It seems fast because the roads are so bad.
Right.
I mean, they bounce a lot and the cars have no suspension. But in L.A., you could get up ahead of steam.
Yeah.
You could be driving 30, 40 miles an hour and hit that cyclist. You can do that. You can knock him for a loop. But I've had friends... Boy, I've had several friends who were hit on their bicycles, hit by bicyclists. You know, it's when people paint this beatific world where we're all riding bicycles, I don't buy it. You know, to me, that's like, you know, swimming with the sharks. You don't.
Well, in
you know.
LA, particularly because it's just so spread out.
No,
it's so spread out. You know, if I lived in Portland, maybe, or you know, I was
too
just...
hilly.
It is kind of hilly. I was just in Madison, Wisconsin, which is a lovely town, which you could easily be a cyclist in.
Easily be a cyclist there if you can handle the humidity.
Well, and also if you can handle 8 months of freezing. but in general, are there things – like what do you want to do still? Like what do you – when you look back on your life, you go, okay, I've done everything I wanted to do. You go, no, I've done a lot of stuff, but there's still so many things that I still want to do.
Yeah, the changing me, the dot that's changed me. I used to be someone who only wanted to do theater and then someone who only wanted to act. Now the me is I want to write. and that's all I like doing. Dangerous Animals Club, a book pretty much of some of my stories that were on the podcast, and now I have a new book at Simon & Schuster that this medium here, the podcast medium, is instantaneous. The literary medium is like glacial. Yeah. I had 15 months to write this book. I wrote it. I turned it in. My editor has been reading it now for 4 months. Then I get, you know, he gives suggestions for rewrites and things like that. I have 3 months to answer those suggestions. Then he does we do it again. Then it goes to copy editors twice. Then they pick the paper. Then they pick the design. And you are dead before the book comes out. So, but what I love now is I love literature and I love writing probably more than anything. If when you perform live, time exists in a certain frame. And like here on this podcast, you know, time exists in a certain manner that we're sitting here talking. When you write, time moves much more quickly. The human eye and the human mind moves far more quickly in terms of communication. And it is such a challenge to begin to tell the story and keep ahead of the reader. And it is a mystery and a challenge. So this is the new vast frontier for me, is hopefully getting to write more. I love it. I love the process. I love telling a story. I'm kind of a solitary kind of person anyway. I'm not a gadfly. I don't like the parties. I don't like going out after dark. You know, I just don't. I like getting up early in the morning and writing, and that's what I love. That's where I hope to be in 5 years, is sitting at home writing still.
So what are the things that you've done? So we know you're a pianist. We know you write music. We know you're a writer. We know that you have ESP, and we know that you're an actor. What else? What are some other things about you? I feel like you're someone who has like 1,000 things that you like to try a lot of different things, play with a lot of different things, master a lot of different things. So what are some other things?
Well, I'm a bad writer of music. The music I write is terrible. I like to direct. Mm-hmm. So I direct plays and things. I'm a pretty good director at that. When I was young, I wanted to be a scientist. So I wanted to be a geologist, and I still study science and geology. I'm fascinated with philosophy. Mm-hmm. And so I love studying ideas and reading about ideas. I love that kind of stuff. Again, you're dealing with the addition-subtraction thing. As I have gotten older, I have become limited by my increasing decrepitude. The thing about decrepitude, for the you people out there who are becoming more decrepit as the clock ticks, is you never are able to identify the beginning of decrepitude. You end up right in the middle of decrepitude before you even know what happens. I was walking through the park, and my leg gave way. Just gave way. I drew a crowd. Like, people get, you need any help, sir? They call you, sir. Want us to call an ambulance? No, I'll get home. I ended up that I tore my meniscus.
Oh, shit.
Shit, yes, indeed. Walking through the park. I go to the Job Clinic, you know, where all those athletes go to look at their injuries. And they said, well, this happens when you get your age. You know, it just happens. And I said, well, what can I do about it? Surgery? No, that has its own problems too. It's just going to be something you're going to have to manage over time. You know, just be careful. Be careful of sport. Once again, it's
like, be careful of sports.
Sports. Back in that. But see, I had experience between 13 and 15.
You did.
Of turning down the sports. So I will be able to rechannel my life in another way. But you have to start managing your limitations. And that's a form of addition, isn't it?
I think most people would. A lot of people would probably say it's a subtraction. But how do you see it as an addition? So that
being
people
able
understand?
To manage. Your subtraction.
Being able to manage subtraction is an addition.
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Like instead of being a victim of your subtraction, like I have a missing tooth back here that they're going to do one of those implants, titanium implants.
Yep.
So now I'm like Uncle Joe, who's moving kind of slow, spitting tobacco out the hole in his tooth back there. I have these legs that I can't run on. I've had open heart surgery. I've had a broken neck. I've had all this stuff. But I have managed my subtraction in such a way that I can still sit back and watch House Hunters with the best of us.
And House Hunters International?
Oh, yeah. That's my dirty pleasure.
I love it when they go to Bulgaria and then they look at all the apartments and then they're basically these dirt caves that have nothing, no bathroom fixtures, no toilets. And then they come back like 3 months later, quote unquote, and it's just like it's a completely transformed completely transformed space.
And I look at it, you know, it's like these horrible, but you know what I do is I get that last channel switch and I go to the weather channel. So I watch House Hunters International, them building a place in Honduras, and then I switch over to the weather channel to see if their place was hit by a hurricane yet.
You're just checking up.
I go back and forth. I toggle back and forth. Are they still there? Still there? No, probably not. Or it's amazing to me how expensive those places are in Bulgaria.
Yeah.
I mean, they have a hanging light bulb, they have a goat in the hallway, and they said it's going to cost you $9,000 a month to rent this place. What?
And the goat's extra. The goat is extra.
Oh, yeah, the goat.
It doesn't come with
it. We can negotiate.
BYOG.
We can negotiate with the former owner on the goat.
Actually, correct that. The goat is the former owner. So you're going to have to negotiate with him. Bring cans. This is going to be a couple different directions. First being to see getting older as an addition is a very wonderful philosophy, because it's not like if we are lucky, we'll get there. It's not like you have a choice. Time marches forward. We get older. That's how it is. You know, obviously we hold on to one of the things that we spend a lot of our time with is holding on to the youth part of it. When I was younger, I blah, 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 you know. So, you know, but I feel like there's real value and there's real merit in just sort of embracing, you know, where you are and not trying to fight so hard. So how did you learn to do that?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I have. There is something that Albert Einstein, that guy, the E=MC² guy, he wrote these essays when he was younger on moral philosophy and all these kind of things too. And in one of his earlier essays, he said that there are two things that we are sure of as people. One, we are overwhelmed with the meaninglessness of life. We're hit constantly, daily, like, is this going to add up to any purpose? Is this going to matter at all? And at the same time, with the same mind and the same insight, we see enormous design in the huge shapes that surround us, in the animal, in the evolution of the animal kingdom, in the stars, in as a scientist looking into subatomic world, we see all sorts of order that says, wait a minute, there's enormous order around me. There's enormous, and order equates as purpose mm-hmm. in our head. We see order as purpose. So we're hit with this complete lack of purpose, and we're hit with this complete sense that we are in the middle of a sea of purpose. And there is this tightrope wire that connects the two, and the tension between these two is belief. And it is what you believe, I think, is what will give you strength to carry forward through the ages of subtraction. You have to, what is it, Bob Dylan? You got to serve somebody, serve the devil, serve the Lord. But you know, you in your life, you are going to end up believing in something that you have no proof for. You're going to believe in something invisible, whatever it is, be it science, be it God, be it poetry, be it something invisible, and that will either pull you through or will not pull you through. And for me, I've jumped around in my life. I've jumped around, and I see how the wisdom of Solomon, like in the Bible, of saying all is vanity. And I go like, man, and he didn't even live in L.A. You could see it everywhere. Like on the set yesterday, everybody taking selfies. Mm-hmm. It's a crazy obsession, and it started off with all the people who didn't have a lot. And on the set, you see it too, like extras, people on the crew. Those are the people that would take selfies. And then it jumped to the elite group, the producers and the heads of the studio. They're taking selfies. And all the people in the middle who are working and everything, they usually don't. Yeah, and why was I saying that about it? It is I don't know. I lost my selfie track.
You were talking about purpose versus not purpose, and then that we find some meaning in this otherwise meaningless world. Belief controls.
And here again, taking a selfie is an example. Says I want this moment that is meaningless to have some kind of meaning.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm saying, like, here I am. I met fucking R2-D2 in the lobby.
But you know what's interesting is that the net result of the net oh, this is so fucking weird. I've never thought of it this way. Maybe this won't be a startling point to anyone. The net result of trying to create meaning in an otherwise meaningless situation means that you're not experiencing the situation because you're trying to give the situation meaning. So you are therefore rendering the meaningless inert because you are trying to preserve it. It's almost a Heisenberg uncertainty principle of socializing. What a fucked up, bizarre.
So do the people out there, do they know about the uncertainty principle?
I would imagine if they listen to the podcast.
You know
one of two things, yeah.
They are either where you are,
mm-hmm,
or where you're going.
Position and direction, right.
Where you are or where you're going. And hey, you know that? there's a good answer to that college fella who wrote me, you know one of two things in college and trying to find the real me, you know where you are, or you know where you're going, but you can't know both.
It's so fucked up. It's so fucked up. And that is, you know, it's kind of funny because this quantum physics doesn't behave. Like, it doesn't behave the way big things behave, but I still feel like there are principles that we express. And so in a way, we are that.
Oh, we are totally that. And I think even though people in quantum physics say, well, that world, that nano world operates differently than our world, I see the quantum world existing totally in the way people interact. One of the great examples people gave of explaining the quantum world is flipping the coin. Like when the referee flips the coin at the beginning of the Super Bowl, that it is both heads and tails at the same time.
Right.
But once you call it, and once it lands, you not only define your choice, and the coin not only tells you whether you win or lose, but it defines the relationship you have to the coin. If you call heads and it's heads, it defines your relationship to the coin and to the other team. And I think that's what happens with everything we do in life. It's this flipping coin, and as soon as we make the choice – hey, what did I say? Do something? As soon as you do something, it is stopping that coin and creating a relationship. And it creates your relationship with the world in which you say, I do something, instead of I'm someone who watches House Hunters.
What if – well, of course, you have to make the meaningless meaningful, and that's what House Hunters International does. What if choice is – the unifying field theory between the quantum world and the cosmological world? Like, what if the idea of, like, what's the unified field theory? What relates the way that very small things interact with versus the way that very big things interact? And what if we're the key somehow? What if we were placed here by some alien species to develop and ultimately be the key, the connection point between the quantum world and cosmology? Has anyone used your ESP? What's happening?
Well, you had me until the aliens came.
Shit, okay.
But
well,
other
X-Files
than that,
is in production now, and that's where my brain went.
You gave a perfect rendering of medieval philosophy. medieval philosophy of the earth being at the center of the universe. Mm-hmm. You know, we being here, that mankind was here. And if you see those plates of glass of windows of the layers of seven heavens, mm-hmm. The seven heavens correspond to the seven spheres that they thought existed then, right? And the earth was the third sphere. That's because they were wrong, right? They were wrong, and they thought there were only seven planets because they didn't know how many planets. But the third sphere, cosmologically, in medieval cosmology, is the sphere of pain and is the sphere of trial. And what did you just say? This is so fucked up! And again, we are in medieval cosmology that we are at the sphere of trial. And we can make choices to try to get through our trial. We can make choices to try to change our subtraction to addition. But we are in the sphere of trial. And that's what any good person in the medieval times would believe. So I'm with you on that. I am a medievalist too.
I certainly appreciate that. But as you're describing that thing, I'm like, oh, yes, of course. I'm a human being. Of course I think we're the center of the universe. Like that's... Of course, this is a very fallacious point of view.
Here is something wild. This is something wild about extending beyond what we are and who we are. For years, everybody has said spiders make a web, mm-hmm. right? And they put gooey stuff on some of the strands and not gooey stuff on the other so the spider can navigate the web without getting stuck in her own web. Well, that was until like some scientists, and I think it's an old experiment. I think it's over 10 years ago. A scientist said, wait a minute. We're looking at this like us human beings are the center of the world. We're looking at it with a human being brain and human being eyes. What if we looked at it the way an insect looks at a spider web? And so she concocted this thing with lenses because they have, what, compound eyes, mm-hmm. and they see different spectra of light in which – she photographed a spider web using insect vision. And what did it become? The area where the spider had put sticky stuff became an image. And where there was no sticky stuff vanished. And it became the image of a flower.
Oh.
And the spider in the middle of the flower became the pistil, or that thing in the middle.
You're blowing my fucking mind.
No. But get this. The spider doesn't have the same optic system of an insect. They have those eight eyes on the – they're not insects. They're arachnids. They have the eight eyes on the front of their head, right? So the spider painting with sunlight on a web is creating an image that it hopes this insect that it does not know or understand will see and be attracted. So if the spider paints the web beautifully – And in a way in which it fools the insect, the spider will live and will eat. If the spider does not create a proper web in sunlight, she will die. So it is the superior artist who lives.
Oh, and also, beautiful things will kill you.
Well, we know that.
What an incredible – that's such a wonderful way to – I mean, there are – philosophical extrapolations from nature and from these is that your particular field of interest is that type of nature philosophy?
Well,
that's so fascinating.
It's mind-boggling. I like all stuff, but the more we get to the atomic world, I really love the atomic world, and I love that stuff. But I feel the atomic world, you know, that's what we are, and it's all one thing. I was just reading last week a new article about these pitcher plants that capture ants.
Right.
Right,
the
in
water,
South America.
The liquid in the –
So there was this one pitcher plant that the people were dissing. They were saying it was a lame-ass pitcher plant. They said,
what
it's not that sticky and the lips aren't good and the ants.
Why were they trolling the?
Yeah, trolling the pitcher plant. And the ants can run in and out of it. That was until it rains. Because of the construct of the pitcher plant, once it rains, the nectar within the pitcher plant is not really much nectar. because it doesn't want to waste resources. But once it rains, the lame design of the pitcher plant makes it almost impossible for the ants to leave. And because the pitcher plants are so lame at being pitcher plants, more ants go into them. So once it rains, they feast and they devour everything, which means the pitcher plant, which has less brains than a spider, which, I mean, has the brain the size of a needle, and the spider is able to understand the optic system of an insect, which still doesn't have our brains, but the pitcher plant that has no brain at all not only understands the behavior of ants, that they will swarm if it's an ineffective pitcher plant, but it also understands the nature of rain. It also understands that once it rains, and it has designed itself in such a way that the rain will make it impossible for this army of ants to escape them. This pitcher plant knows all things that are important to the pitcher. The pitcher plant probably thinks it's at the center of the damn universe.
Well, I do relate to this particular type of pitcher plant because I feel like I only thrive in inclement weather. But then I also think, well, you know, we're placing a lot of value within the perceived choices of the pitcher plant. Maybe the ants are responsible because the ants going into something that they don't perceive as a threat create this sort of, you know, they kick the natural selection into gear that makes those types of plants more viable.
You just said it. You just answered the question. You just did it right here, right now. You just answered the question. That's what choice is. Choice is our way to bypass natural selection. It is evolution is the pitcher plant's brain, right? The pitcher plants that are more efficient and look better, they die out because they don't end up being able to kill a herd of ants. And the spiders, the ones that don't become good artists, they die. And in Iceland, the horses that throw people off their backs, they get eaten. They become hot dogs. Very good hot dogs. You could buy them there.
Good for hot dog makeouts.
In Selfoss, there is a hot dog stand that the wonderful hot dogs that I think have horse in them. But but choice is our way of bypassing natural selection. We make the choice to say I'm not going to live my life in Dallas and work and struggle there in theater. I'm going to come out to Los Angeles and try to become an actor. I'm going to try to write my stories. I'm making certain choices that bypass evolution. We hope. You know, that is the whole idea of science and medicine, right?
That is the most you can do. And then circling it back to what you said at the beginning of the podcast, your choice to do something is the ultimate power that you have in the universe.
Yeah, it is. The biggest gift we have is time, and the only way we can honor it is with choice, is what I said. And that is right. The most power we have is choice. So use it, and use it wisely.
And also, if you're going to put horse in your hot dogs, I think they should be called hot ponies. That's just my opinion. I think it would catch on, and I feel like people should do it. I also think you should call a book The Age of Subtraction, because that was a very good phrase.
That's a good phrase.
Yeah, and that's yours, so you should do something. You could do something with that.
The Age of Subtraction. I love that.
Not to get too much like my mom on you. We're like, you should do something with that, but I think The Age of Subtraction – I don't know what, you know, I just think it's, if I heard that about, that is an intriguing title. I want to know what that book is. Maybe that is your fictionalized account of the philosophical implications of choice. Maybe that's sort of.
I love that title. That is a fabulous title. I'm going to steal that from you via me.
Please, please. Please just let it be a handoff. And how strange it is, and somehow I've managed to not mention it the entire podcast, that one of my favorite films of all time, Groundhog Day, is about nothing but choice.
Choice. Groundhog Day is about nothing but choice, absolutely. And when I first read that script, you know, it wasn't so clearly about that. What it was an excuse for Bill Murray to have no consequences, and one crazy event after another, and Bill robbing banks, and Bill with women, and stealing cars, and all of this stuff. And then at the end, he gets bored with it, tries to kill himself. That doesn't work, and then decides not to be a jerk. But it was, you know, Harold Ramis, Danny Rubin, a week into shooting, said, "What are we doing here? We're telling the story of how we use our time. Let's get and." They completely redid the script, and we were getting pages hot off the presses. I mean, while we were shooting, first, second day, we're going like, oh, my God, what are we a part of? This is so awesome. And it became the film we know today after we were shooting that – They took the work seriously.
Well, isn't the idea based on, I'm sure I'm butchering this, so I apologize, internet. I was understanding that it was based on a Chinese proverb that it takes 10,000 years for a man to change?
I'm not sure if it was based on that because you are right in its essence in that Harold Ramis, who was a practicing Buddhist, said that it takes 10,000 years for the human soul to perfect itself. Oh. And so when they say how long is Bill Murray trapped in Woodstock or Punxsutawney, wherever he was trapped in the movie, it's Punxsutawney, for real it was Woodstock, and we were trapped. But they have all sorts of theories that there were 9 days, there were 44 days, someone says 166 years, and they worked all this stuff out. And Harold Ramis told me, no, Stephen, it's 10,000 years.
Wow.
It's 10,000 years based on whatever that idea is, that it takes 10,000 years for a human soul to perfect itself. But that's how he was able to play the piano so well.
Well, and also at the end to actually care about other people and have devoted his life to really sort of that idea, which I assume it comes from Harold's Buddhist faith that, you know, the true value in life is contribution, you know, and that's how he chose to spend the last remaining years, is just making that town a better place in as much power as he had to make those choices.
He did something. He did something. And he spent his whole day doing something, whether it was saving the kid falling from the tree or saving the mayor, choking on the piece of steak, trying to keep the old man alive, helping the old ladies with their flat tire. He was doing something with his life. And by doing that, he had nothing but gain.
Yeah.
Nothing but
it was all addition. You satisfying, not that you shouldn't do things for yourself and be happy, but if you just focus on yourself, if you just, as Yes used to say, surround yourself with yourself, you are a dead end. You are a cul-de-sac because you have to be a part of this community to then thrive for the next generation. Like, you're just not going to be happy just trying to satisfy your own whims all the time.
Yeah, unless you have a really good Mercedes.
Unless you have a great Mercedes.
That's right.
Then that gets somebody like that. If you don't have that, then I don't know what to tell you.
You're lost.
If you have you're that, lost, you know. Then everything's fine.
Yeah, I have found that when I've been limited by circumstance, I have found that the body adapts very quickly to the new boundaries, like when I had the broken neck.
Yeah.
The body adapts to the new boundaries of what you have, and you fill those boundaries. Viktor Frankl, who survived Auschwitz, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, which I think is one of the greatest books ever written. If you've never read it, you have to read Man's Search for Meaning, and it's short. It's amazing. But one of the things he says in that book is that sorrow operates like a gas. It fills every available space. And the same thing, too, with meaning. Meaning can fill every available space. If you're able to fill your life with meaning, you will have a successful life, like Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. He filled his day with meaning. It wasn't climbing to the top of the Weather Channel or whatever. You know, Phil Connors expected he was going to get being a celebrity weatherman, but he achieved meaning in his life, and consequently he found that kind of fullness. It's interesting in Judaism, you know, the word shalom, which everyone says means peace or hello, but also another meaning of shalom is complete, whole. And so people seek completeness, to feel complete, which is why, you know, the poor man's complete is getting drunk and passing out.
Yeah.
You know, that's the poor man's complete. You know, I'm done. I'm full. I'm done.
That's. I also feel like the word integrity is always misused because people assume that it has a certain value where they go, oh, integrity means someone's a good person. It doesn't mean that. It means wholeness. It means something is whole. It means something is complete. So if someone has integrity, it doesn't mean they're a good person. It just means that they're consistent with whatever their with their thing is. They're structurally intact.
Yes, 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 yes. Another thing people ignore is ignorance. Ignorance.
Right.
Ignorance as meaning stupid as opposed to they ignore. They ignore. Ignorance of the law is not an excuse. It's that you – it isn't that you're a dummy and you don't know the law. But it's not an excuse if you ignore the law.
Right. So if I kick someone in the face, that's not okay.
That's not okay, man.
But I didn't know that wasn't okay before. So
ignorance of the law is surely, not an excuse.
Surely that means that I can get away with stuff because I didn't know.
No, and don't call me Shirley.
All right. Oh, such a good call. Such a good reference. Are there ever other movies where you watch, like when you watch Airplane, you're like, fuck, I wish I was in that movie.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. It's so perfect. It's one of the perfect movies. And I watch Julie's performance in that time and time and time again. And I am amazed at how, you know, everybody thinks of that as the wackiest, studio-less kind of movie in the world. But her character is so real in that movie. It is amazing. No.
Everyone is super real.
Super real.
That was they were all playing drama. In a ridiculous setting.
In a ridiculous...
That's why it was so good. They weren't... There was no awareness. The only person who was slightly aware in that movie was Ted Stryker, a.k.a. Robert Hayes, who would occasionally wink to the camera. But everyone else was in it.
And now, you know, Sigmund Freud was talking about the different types of comedy. And he says the shortest shelf life of comedy is satire, which is comedy, you know, of... our age, you know, like Saturday Night Live or whatever. Can you believe how many things in Airplane people aren't going to know what the hell they're doing anymore? Like the service where they're cleaning the windows of the airplane. Like there's no full service anymore. Like no. Nobody does the filling station like that anymore.
No.
The smoking or non-smoking. You know,
right.
You don't have smoking on airplanes anymore.
No. No, now it's you can't just meet someone at their gate.
Right. You can't meet someone at the gate and everybody running to the gate. They don't have payphones.
No payphones.
You know, it's all gone.
Way to miss the boat, Airplane, on what was going on now.
I just tell that, you know, to people in my comedy class and things like that who are writing things. I said, be careful about, you know, if you do a popular reference because – in about 6 weeks, people aren't going to know it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's going to be gone.
Unless your output is so high that that is your thing, is that you can constantly be commenting in the moment. But
right.
If you don't do that, it burns out. It burns out real fast. Where do you teach your comedy class?
Oh, I teach it in Burbank, which is kind of where we're at. I think I'm doing my next session in September, but it's through Kalmanson and Kalmanson.
Oh, voice casting. Yeah,
voice casters. Yeah. So anyway, they branched out from just doing VO classes, voiceover classes, and they wanted me to teach. I teach two different kinds of improv classes and a comedy class, and I teach maybe three sessions a year.
That's great.
It's interesting. I learn a lot. I had one police officer who was in the class, and I was just asking, I don't know who the people are. I said, have you ever improvised in your life? He goes, oh, yeah, yeah. I said, when did you improvise? He says, oh, well, I'm a police officer. I was undercover, and I was being flown by these drug guys over the Gulf of Mexico, and they were going to shoot me in the head and dump my body into the Gulf. And so I start improvising. I said, you start improvising. What did you do? He says, talk about women. What do you think? Talk about women, the women I had and all sorts of things. Talk about sex and all this. Got them all laughing and all that kind of stuff. Talked about the kind of piece of tail I got when I'm going to land and all that kind of stuff. And then I took their firearm from them. I killed them both.
Jesus.
I know.
Yes, and bullets.
And yes, and we're Liam Neeson, you know, and now he's taking my improv class, this guy.
Excuse me, Albanians. I'm going to need a suggestion. Give me a location. Now I'm going to need an occupation.
Oh, I have all types in that class. It's amazing. It's amazing. I learn a lot.
So just as we quickly wrap up, what is the first thing that you say, just so people get an idea? Everyone sits down, first class. First thing out of your mouth, what do you say to welcome them to the class?
I give them notebooks,
mm-hmm.
and I said, from now on and for the rest of your life, I want you to write down everything you see that's remarkable. You don't have to be literary about it. You don't have to be funny. You don't have to be dramatic. It could be like, I had no idea they had so many kinds of beer at Gelson's. Just write it down, and it will become the book of your life.
I knew you'd be a great guest, but you were even better than I thought you would be.
Hooray!
And it's such an honor to meet you, and I've been a fan for a long time, and I hope you come back. And if there's ever anything we can do to help you with anything, please let it please us.
Well, my car could use a wash.
I will wash your snazzy Mercedes.
Yeah.
I know you'll probably want to, like a lot of drug cartels, poke my eyes out so I'm not staring at it. And I'm just so that I don't see exactly I don't deserve the beauty. But I'll wash your car for you.
Thank you.
And so anything you want to plug, anything you want to promote?
Certainly the Tobolowsky Files. We have a new podcast, David Chin and I, an advice podcast called Big Problems, which is kind of fun. And they're both on iTunes now, Tobolowsky Files and Big Problems. If you're the TV kind of person, definitely watch Big Time in Hollywood, Florida on Comedy Central. Mm-hmm. It is hysterical. I love this show, and I think Dan Schimpf and Alex Omfanger, mm-hmm. the creators, I think if they haven't been on your show, these guys are brilliant.
Okay.
And it is just a wonderfully funny show. That's a big one. And everybody out there could keep our fingers crossed for my new story movie, The Primary Instinct. I did a concert in Seattle of my stories. 1,000 people in the theater, filmed Chicago group, and now it's going to premiere, I think, in May.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so we'll see. Fingers crossed.
Congratulations. And are you just at Tobolowsky on Twitter?
I'm at Tobolowsky on Twitter. And if people go to stephentobolowsky.com,
yeah,
like they'll get all my handles. Is that what they call it? Like for Facebook, yes. Twitter, all that stuff.
Tobolowsky. No, Wsky.
Yeah, Tobolowsky. And Stephen.
It's a ph and a w.
It's a ph and a w.
Stephen Tobolowsky. It's a pleasure to meet you. And I will admit to you that I just bought a piece of art with your face on it.
Oh no, you did!
I'll show it to you. I put it in my Instagram feed. Someone did a series of colored pencil renderings, and I bought Ned Ryerson and I bought Igor from Young Frankenstein.
That is fantastic. I would love to see it. I was invited to the show, and I'm glad to know it had a happy home.
It has a very happy home. So I'll hopefully see you soon.
Well, thank you.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone. Enjoy. Choose to enjoy your burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.